key reasons why I have been targeted.
Begg has been accused of support for extremist groups in the past over his aid and investigative work in war zones such as Syria and Afghanistan, but was always found to be innocent. The Home Office has yet to publicly comment on this latest passport matter.
This battle will be very significant, especially given the fact that Number 10 is currently trying to gift itself new powers to essentially remove people's citizenship at will with the controversial Nationality and Borders Bill. Many critics fear that the government just simply can't be trusted to wield powers like this fairly. Robert Carter, London.
It's been 1 year since U.S. President Joe Biden took office after defeating his contender Donald Trump in the 2020 presidential election. He took charge of the Oval Office with lots of promises, but let's look at where he's standing after 365 days. For one thing, Biden promised to bring the coronavirus pandemic in the country under control after Trump failed to do so. At the moment, the United States continues to be the world's worst hit country by COVID-19, with more than 68 million cases and over 858,000 deaths. Infections in the past weeks have been jumping, reaching an average of over 800,000 cases a day. This is while, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, only 63% of the American population is fully vaccinated, and the numbers in southern states are much lower.
Look, folks, we're going to bring the Republicans and Democrats together and deliver economic relief for working families and schools and businesses.
These were Biden's words when he promised to get bipartisan cooperation to boost the U.S. economy and support the working class as, quote, the backbone of the society. Now we see that rift has not only widened between the two parties, but even the Democrats are divided over the issue, as some criticize Biden for not being bold or progressive enough with his agenda. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders says Democrats are on the wrong path and need to make a major course correction, pivoting back toward the needs of working Americans. Sanders believes that in too many ways, the Democratic Party has turned its back on the working class. Turning to foreign policy, Biden said last February that the U.S. would step up diplomacy to end the war in Yemen.
We're also stepping up our diplomacy to end the war in Yemen, a war which has created a humanitarian and strategic catastrophe.
But it looks like he couldn't keep that promise either. In December, the Senate supported Biden's $650 billion weapons sales to Saudi Arabia, even though Riyadh continues to target Yemeni civilians with airstrikes on an almost daily basis. Tensions between the United States and Russia have also escalated under Biden's presidency, especially more recently over Ukraine, with both Moscow and Washington targeting each other with tit-for-tat sanctions, while warning against a complete rupture in their relations. And regarding the 2015 deal between Iran and the P5 plus one group of countries, Biden had this to say back in 2020, that his predecessor Trump had recklessly ditched the agreement, pledging that the U.S. would rejoin the deal under his presidency. But the Biden administration has been keeping the so-called maximum pressure campaign on Iran in place and has even imposed more sanctions against many entities and individuals, showing no serious intention in getting back into that agreement. The latest polls suggest that Biden is entering his second year in office with the worst job approval rating yet. Affected by the COVID chaos, the messy and deadly U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan in late August, Biden's approval ratings started relatively strong at 57%, but by September they plunged to 43%. A new poll by Gallup and Morning Consult finds only 40% of U.S. adults currently approve of the job he is doing, his lowest to date. All in all, in the eyes of both Americans and the world, Biden has had a very disappointing record for his first year in office.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi made an official visit to Moscow on Wednesday at the invitation of his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. This is the first trip to Russia by an Iranian president since 2017. During a meeting in the Kremlin, the two sides set for talks on mutual and regional issues.
We have no limitation for expansion and development of ties with Russia and are after establishment of strategic relations with Moscow. We can expand our relations in economy, trade on the political track. We are not talking about momentary relations. We are talking about a sustainable and strategic relationship.
For his part, the Russian president said Iran-Russia's relations have been constantly improving. He also acknowledged Tehran and Moscow's contribution to Syria's transition past the terrorist threats.
Thanks to our efforts, we have largely succeeded in helping the Syrian government overcome the threats posed by international terrorism. Now, of course, both you and us are concerned about the situation that is developing in Afghanistan. I would like to discuss all these issues with you to know your position on these problems. And of course, it is very important for me to know your position on the JCPOA.
Iran's Raisi underlined that his country will never give in to the West's pressure, including the U.S., adding that Iran is seeking to remove the U.S. illegal and unilateral sanctions.
We have been confronting the U.S. for more than 40 years. We hope that these efforts would lead to removal of the sanctions. The threat of sanctions cannot come in the way of Iran's progress.
Ahead of the visit of Iran's Raisi to Moscow, Iranian Foreign Minister Hussein Amir Abdollahian said that his country followed a new roadmap to deepen ties with Moscow, adding that Iran and Russia were determined to update a 20-year cooperation treaty that they signed in 2001.
This is Iranian president's third foreign trip since taking office in July last year. The visit is seen by observers as the latest efforts by Iran and Russia to cement stronger ties amid U.S. hostile policies towards both countries. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Biden has wasted a vital year doubling down on Trump's failed policies. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written jointly by Media Benjamin and Nicholas J.S. Davis, anti-war activists. This article is published under the heading, After a Year of Biden, There is a Still Trump-Era Foreign Policy. Stay tuned for more. Joe Biden and the Democrats were highly critical of Donald Trump's foreign policy, so it was reasonable to expect that Biden would quickly remedy its worst impacts. Tragically for America and the world, Biden has failed to restore progressive initiatives and has instead doubled down on many of Trump's most dangerous and destabilizing policies. It is especially ironic and sad that a president who ran so stridently on being different from Trump has been so reluctant to reverse his regressive policies. Now the Democrats' failure to deliver on their promises with respect to both domestic and foreign policy is undermining their prospects in November's midterm election. Here is the assessment of Biden's handling of 10 critical foreign policy issues. Number one, prolonging the agony of the people of Afghanistan. It is perhaps symptomatic of Biden's foreign policy problems that the signal achievement of his first year in office was an initiative launched by Trump to withdraw the U.S. from its 20-year war in Afghanistan. But Biden's implementation of this policy was tainted by the same failure to understand Afghanistan that doomed and bogged at least three prior administrations and the hostile military occupation for 20 years, leading to the speedy restoration of the Taliban government and televised chaos of the U.S. withdrawal. Now, instead of helping the Afghan people recover from two decades of U.S.-inflicted destruction, Biden has seized $9.4 billion in Afghan foreign currency reserves, while the people of Afghanistan suffer through a desperate humanitarian crisis. It is hard to imagine how even Donald Trump could be more cruel or vindicative. Number two, provoking a crisis with Russia over Ukraine. Biden's first year in office is ending with a dangerous escalation of tensions at the Russia-Ukraine border, a situation that threatens to devolve into a military conflict between the world's two most heavily armed nuclear states. The U.S. bears much responsibility for this crisis by supporting the violent overthrow of the elected government of Ukraine in 2014, backing NATO expansion right up to Russia's border, and arming and training Ukrainian forces. Biden's failure to acknowledge Russia's legitimate security concerns has led to the present impasse, and Cold Warriors within his administration are threatening Russia instead of proposing concrete measures to de-escalate the situation. And number three, escalating Cold War tensions and a dangerous arms race with China. Trump launched a tariff war with China that economically damaged both countries and reignited a dangerous Cold War and arms race with China and Russia to justify an ever-increasing U.S. military budget. And political prosecutions of Julian Assange, Daniel Hale, and Guantanamo torture victims. Under Biden, the United States remains a country where the systematic killing of civilians and other war crimes go unpunished, while whistleblowers who muster the courage to expose these horrific crimes to the public are prosecuted and jailed as political prisoners. In July 2021, former drone pilot Daniel Hale was sentenced to 45 months in prison for exposing the killing of civilians in America's drone wars. WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange still languishes in Belmarsh prison in England after 11 years fighting extradition to the United States for exposing U.S. war crimes. 20 years after the U.S. set up an illegal concentration camp at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, to imprison 779 mostly innocent people kidnapped around the world, 39 prisoners remain there in illegal extrajudicial detention. Despite promises to close this sordid chapter of U.S. history, the prison is still functioning, and Biden is allowing the Pentagon to actually build a new closed courtroom to Guantanamo to more easily keep the workings of this gulag hidden from public scrutiny. And also, economic siege warfare against the people of Cuba, Venezuela, and other countries. Biden has continued Trump's failed economic siege warfare against countries that resist U.S. imperial dictates, inflicting endless pain on their people without seriously imperiling, let alone bringing down their governments. Brutal U.S. sanctions and efforts at regime change have universally failed for decades, serving mainly to undermine the U.S. claim to democratic and human rights credentials. Guaido is now the least popular opposition figure in Venezuela, and genuine grassroots movements opposed to U.S. intervention are bringing popular democratic and socialist governments to power across Latin America in Bolivia, Peru, Chile, Honduras, and maybe Brazil in 2022. And the U.S. is still supporting Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen and its repressive ruler. Under Trump, Democrats and a majority of Republicans in Congress gradually built a bipartisan majority that voted to withdraw from the Saudi-led coalition attacking Yemen and to stop sending arms to Saudi Arabia. Trump vetoed their efforts, but the Democratic election victory in 2020 should have led to an end to the war and humanitarian crisis in Yemen. Instead, Biden only issued an order to stop selling offensive weapons to Saudi Arabia without clearly defining that term, and went on to okay a $650 million weapons sale. The U.S. still supports the Saudi war, even as the resulting humanitarian crisis kills thousands of Yemeni children. And despite Biden's pledge to treat the Saudis' cruel leader, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, as a pariah, Biden refused to even sanction MBS for his barbaric murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Still complicit in illegal Israeli regime occupation, settlements, and war crimes, yes, the United States is the Zionist regime's largest arms supplier, and the Zionist regime is the world's largest recipient of U.S. military aid, approximately $4 billion annually. Despite its illegal occupation of Palestine, widely condemned war crimes in Gaza, and illegal settlement building, U.S. military aid and arms sales to the Zionist regime clearly violate the U.S. Lee Laws and Arms Export Control Act. Donald Trump was flagrant in his disdain for Palestinian rights, including transferring the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to a property in Al-Quds. But nothing has changed under Biden. The U.S. position on the Zionist regime and Palestine is as illegitimate and contradictory as ever, and the U.S. embassy remains on illegally occupied land. In May, Biden supported the latest Israeli regime assault on Gaza, which killed 256 Palestinians, half of them civilians, including 66 children. Each part of this foreign policy fiasco costs human lives and creates regional, even global, instability. The United States has squandered unprecedented wealth, global goodwill, and a historic position of international leadership to pursue unattainable imperial ambitions using military force and other forms of violence and coercion in flagrant violation of the UN Charter and international law. As a presidential candidate, Biden promised to restore America's position of global leadership, but as president, he has instead doubled down on the policies through which the U.S. lost that position in the first place under a succession of Republican and Democratic administrations. Trump was only the latest iteration in America's race to the bottom. Biden has wasted a vital year doubling down on Trump's failed policies.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program for humanity. We are looking at human rights from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen, the Commander of the Faithful, Ali alayhi as-salam. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi followed the footsteps of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam when it came to applying justice and being fair, and especially to himself first before all. When we look at the life of the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, we see that the world was removed from under the feet of the Prophet and spread under the feet of others. All the worldly pleasures and adornments were prohibited to him. He was an extreme abstentious person. He never ate his fill, and whatever food he ate was not very rich. He left the world in the manner as mentioned by Abu Dharr, one of his companions. The Prophet never ate two kinds of food during one day. When he ate dates, he did not eat bread. Often, it has so happened that food was not cooked in the house of the Prophet for many months consecutively. And Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi followed foot to that of the Prophet. He said, and it was said, that Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi himself considered only two sheets of clothes to be sufficient for him, and also contented himself with only two loaves of bread per day. His house also resembled the house of the poor people. The instances of Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi abstaining and his contentment are numerous and so well known that we don't even have the time to mention them here. It is also true that his companions like Abu Dharr al-Muqdad, Maitam al-Tamar, and Malik al-Ashtar contented themselves with dry barley bread. Amir al-Mu'mineen was as well as the member of his family ate such bread and were quite happy and content with it. They lived the life of simplicity, the life similar to those who are poor. They did not divide themselves from others because he was in power, because he has a status. It did not allow him, and he did not allow himself to be above the rest. In fact, he made himself as normal as he could be compared to the poorest person in his area, sometimes maybe even poorer. All these things are true and correct about Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi. Therefore, Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he himself, when he wanted to educate people into being humble, into being respectful to others, in taking care of the need of the others, he was himself the guide. He was himself the example. Because when we look at leaders, leaders themselves, they have to lead by an example. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when he sent them down to earth, he sent them for so we can follow in their footsteps. When we see that the leaders and those who are in control, they live a life of extravagant, while the masses suffer from poorness and you know, less quality of everything, then how can we relate to them? How can we even begin to like them, or at least, you know, trying to make them leaders? We can't. So the leaders have to be as simple as the people themselves. Let us take a short break, then we continue, inshallah.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Wow.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program for humanity. We were looking at Amir al-Mu'mineen Salamullah Ali and how he established justice to himself before others. Those who have studied the lives of the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wa Amir al-Mu'mineen and their true companions, they would see that they would have realized that in the very first instant that they were standard and bearers of revolution, and their objective were associated with that revolution. Whatever they did was for the welfare of the people, and they did it with the help of the people. In order to make a revolution successful, they adopted the method which were suited to the country or to the people of the areas and the cities they lived in. Some of those leaders and the leaders of the revolution were those who were killed, for example, Amir al-Mu'mineen Salamullah Ali and the companions of Amir al-Mu'mineen Salamullah Ali, whom enemies could do no harm, and like, for example, the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam. It was not possible for the leaders of the revolution to live a life of luxury and pleasure, because the nature of the revolution did not permit them to do so. Peace of mind is a prerequisite for a life of pleasure, and such peace of mind was not enjoyed by those leaders. The second thing is that the first target of the enemies of the revolution is the leaders of the revolution themselves. Until and unless the revolution succeeds, his life remains constantly in danger, and he remains subjected to oppression and persecution. Now, how could it be possible for a man whose life is constantly in danger to enjoy the worldly bounties and pleasures? This can be possible for him only if his revolution succeeded or he abandoned the revolution, one of the two. However, it is also a fact that the leaders of the revolution were free to lead that type of life they liked and to become contented with such necessities of life as they considered it to be sufficient. Less bread, less food, less clothes. For them, that was more than enough. None could object to their selection or not selecting a particular thing for themselves. They had themselves adopted the life of being abstain and content, but had not compelled others to adopt it. Why? Beside all these things, they themselves, they wanted people to know that they are no different than them, that they are just simple people. And the Quran testifies to that fact in chapter 67, verse 15, when he talks about the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa'ala. He says, he walks on the earth and eats and drinks what people has been provided to you by God. Or walk on the earth and eat and drink what has been provided to you by God. So Allah is saying you are just a simple person. And here the people have been directed to eat and drink because life depends on these acts, obviously. This direction has been given to all people and not to a particular class. Every person is entitled to work and earn his livelihood. We leave it here, and inshallah we will continue in other episodes. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala محمد وآله.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring
event.
In Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
war in Yemen continues at a ferocious velocity. The Saudi-led coalition has bombed dozens of sites, killing tens of civilians, in apparent response to the attack by the Yemeni army deep inside the UAE. Yet the Saudi-led coalition denied carrying out an airstrike on a prison that killed at least 70 people, including migrants, women, and children. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at whether Saudi-led coalition hard-hitting bombing campaign is due to its failures on the battlefield and how vulnerable the UAE is when it comes to being targeted again. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have writer and political commentator Jim Kavanaugh joining us from New York. Also joining us is Yemeni activist and political commentator Hamza Shaban, who joins us from Toronto.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome both of you gentlemen, and let me first start with you, if I may, Jim Kavanaugh. The Saudi-led bombing campaign, it has left dozens of civilians dead in one day as opposed to the preceding bombings, which have killed maybe on a smaller scale, but it's still happening either daily, every other day, or on a weekly basis at a minimum. Don't you think that whether it's 70 in one day or a couple here and there every other day, it still requires the UN to address it?
Certainly do. This has been going on for 7 years now, since 2014, longer than World War II. And this is a vicious war. And it was said a couple of years ago, this is the biggest humanitarian catastrophe in the world. And my president, when he was running for president, Joe Biden, said he would stop giving offensive arms to Saudi Arabia over this. And of course, flip-flopped on that and pushed through an arms sale in December for Saudi Arabia. So, you know, this is a nasty war. The Saudis have the advantage of, you know, these modern fighter bomber jet bomber planes. But the Houthis also have developed precision missile and drone capabilities that are worrisome and have hurt the Saudis and have this time hurt the UAE. And we shouldn't forget, at the beginning of this, when the Houthis came into the capital, they offered to have to let the ruling party join the government. And that was refused, and they ran off to Saudi Arabia and started this war. So you really have a nasty war that only continues with the good graces of the United States and Great Britain. The Security Council made a statement about the Houthi attack on UAE, but they didn't make a statement about the Saudi attack on a prison. What the heck are they doing there? And the U.S. Secretary General did. But, you know, they've kept their hands off of this because they don't want to tie Saudi Arabia's hands.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's look at what reaction the U.S. has had on this. Hamza Shaban, the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, he has said all parties to the conflict need to de-escalate and abide by their obligations under international humanitarian law. Coming from the U.S. that provides arms to Saudi Arabia and the coalition. What's your reaction upon hearing that from the U.S. Secretary of State?
Yeah, thank you very much for having me speak today with you. Definitely, like, if the U.S. thinks that the parties in Yemen, represented by Ansar Allah or the government in Sana'a, or in the U.S. and UAE, and Saudi coalition need to de-escalate this, then they definitely need to start stop arming Saudi Arabia and UAE and providing them with arms so that de-escalation actually takes place and, you know, the whole war stops. But when we see what's happening in Chabwa province and in Marib, what's happening is that UAE and Saudi Arabia continues to fund and arm the fighters who are fighting with them to continue taking more places. So, you know, if there are no practical actions taking place in ground, then definitely whatever the US or UK or UN says does not mean anything. There needs to be practical steps if the US is really serious about de-escalating the war in Yemen.
I'd like to refer an instance that happened just last week, Jim Kavanaugh, about Saudi Arabia and how it accused Iran of a false narrative that has been leveled against Iran time and again by Saudi Arabia. And it had to deal with this footage, which turned out to be from a documentary of a U.S., I guess, invasion of Iraq back in 2003. Accused Iran of being supportive or providing these ballistic missiles in the besieged Red Sea port city of Hodeidah. You have Saudi Arabia coming out, making that accusation, and then coming out later and admitting to it being false. Spokesman of the Saudi-led military coalition in Yemen, Colonel Turki al-Maliki, admitting to this. So how do you take Saudi Arabia's word when it accuses Iran or for any other instances of it trying to lead down a narrative that's to its advantage?
Well, of course, you shouldn't take Saudi Arabia's word. I mean, the United States lied for 20 years about Afghanistan, and people knew it. They said it. They reported it a couple of years before the war ended. This was all a bunch of lies. So you shouldn't take it. You know, you shouldn't take anybody's word. You should take Iran's word. People should look at the evidence. They should see what's going on. And, you know, there's also, this is a war. People are going to get help from various sides. That's what happens. And the United States, nobody has any less right to support the Houthis than to support the factions that Saudi Arabia supports. So these kinds of, you know, silly, phony videos and proof that are offered all the time that turn out to be not proof at all, but just, you know, lies and fact-checking. But it's really all kinds of beside the point. We have to end this war. We have to, as your previous guest said, we have to de-escalate. We have to disarm, and we have to have pressure from the major governments in the world who are keeping this going to do that.
How is that going to happen, Hamza Shehbani, when the governments around the world, if we're talking about some of the Western ones like the UK, France, and the US, continue to provide arms and sell arms to Saudi Arabia and to the UAE and to the coalition, whatever's left of it? As a matter of fact, who is in this coalition that we keep talking about?
In 2015, when it started, Saudi Arabia said that there were 20 countries. But in reality right now, there are only two countries left that are in the front lines, Saudi Arabia and UAE. But they're also backed by Western governments like US, UK, even Canada, France, and a bunch of other countries. But these countries, they're benefiting economically from selling arms to Saudi Arabia and UAE, but they're also pushing them towards hell. Because right now, the war in Yemen is different. It's not like how when it started in 2015. Right now, the Yemeni military have the capabilities and the willingness and the ability to hurt Saudi Arabia and UAE, especially UAE. UAE is a fragile country. Their economy is very fragile. They cannot take or stand the ballistic missiles and the drones that the Yemeni army have promised to be sending very soon. A few other ballistic missiles or drones will definitely send a very strong signal to the investors in the UAE to leave the country, to the expats who are 90% of the population in UAE, almost 10 million people there in UAE are expats. When these people feel that UAE is not a safe place anymore, they will flee and leave UAE. So I really think that these Western governments, yes, they're benefiting economically from the war in Yemen, but they're also pushing UAE and Saudi Arabia towards hell, because Right now, it's different. Yemeni people can defend themselves, and they can also hurt these countries.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the UAE, if we can here, Jim Kavanaugh, where the latest coming from the Ansarullah fighters in terms of a warning is that foreign companies need to leave the UAE. It's unsafe there, they have said. In a veiled threat of revenge attacks, we, quote, advise the foreign companies in Emirates to leave because they invest in an unsafe country, and the rulers of this country continue in their aggression against Yemen. So if I'm sitting there in some palace in the UAE, I would really think twice about this. So are they thinking twice and wanting not to get engaged, but they're being pushed to, maybe? Or what is the thinking behind them still engaged? Even though they have said, if you want to look at the record, that 2 years ago they announced their official withdrawal.
Yeah, they withdrew their ground troops, and then recently, but what they do is they fund and support these militia, which are essentially jihadi militia. They don't want to put their own troops in there. As what your previous guest said previously is absolutely correct. This is a very dangerous situation for Saudi Arabia and UAE. These are fragile regimes, ultimately. And if they start getting hurt, you know, and they were hurt, look at them. I think it was 2020 when the Houthis hit those Saudi oil facilities, and they were pinpoint hits. So there are now, and they cannot hold territory. They don't want to put their forces in there. That's why they rely on airstrikes. That's what they're going to do. They were losing the battles of Marib. The ground troops they're going to use are these militias that they're going to pay for, mercenaries, essentially. But, you know, Saudi Arabia got into this MBS thinking this was going to be an easy win, and it'll pump up his image and the Saudi image in the region, and it's turned out to be exactly the opposite. And the longer this goes on, the more fragile those regimes are, the more likely those regimes are going to be hurt in serious ways.
There's another case here, the attack that took place on the UAE, Hamza Shaiban, that I'd like to ask you, and that is the way that Israel came out, apparently in a rescue attempt, where the Israeli Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, said, quote, "We stand ready to offer you, the UAE, security and intelligence support in order to help you protect your citizens from similar attacks." Further saying that I've ordered the Israeli security establishment to provide the counterparts in the UAE with any assistance. Now, does this mean that Israel is thinking of either becoming more involved in this war or directly maybe involved in this war militarily?
I think there are, you know, 2 points to address here. The first one is that I think Israel is trying to blackmail UAE, because we also, last year when there was a war between the Palestinians and Israel could not defend itself. They could not stop the missiles coming outside of Palestine striking Israel. How can they save UAE right now from this war? And we all know that the capabilities of the Yemeni military is way more advanced than what they have in Palestine. This is the first thing. Second thing is that I think Israel is also worried right now, because the fact that the Yemeni army could target Abu Dhabi means that their missiles and their drones could also reach to Eilat port in the occupied land of Palestine. So this is also worrying for the Israelis as well. Now, Israel has been involved in this war in an indirect way, but it seems that the role in the coming days might be more direct and more obvious, which is also going to cause threat to themselves, because as Sayyid Abdulmalik al-Houthi has warned Israel 3 years ago that if they're getting involved in this war, then they should expect that Yemeni people would defend themselves, and they would target some strategic sites inside Israel.
Indeed. And there's another angle to why Israel may be interested, Matt, in this, Jim Kavanaugh, and that is, I'm going to refer to another statement here by the Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, in which he said, "Israel is committed to working closely with you, the UAE, in the ongoing battle against extremist forces, and we will continue to partner with you to defeat our common enemies." Now, who can Israel be referring to when it says that, other than Iran?
Nobody. It's that's what it's referring to. It's referring to Iran. They see a victory of the Houthis as a victory for Iran. Again, to the extent to which Iran supports, is supportive of in some way or another of the Houthis, then that's going to be something that does benefit.
Well, you know what? I'm asking this question, Matt. I'm asking this question, Jim Kavanaugh. Sorry to jump in. Is because I'm looking at the fact that Israel is going to play the UAE to try to come in through this window to get at Iran somehow. One way or another, trying to push the UAE or maybe give ultimatums down the road, the UAE maybe not realizing this, because obviously Israel wants to get at Iran in any shape or form.
But it also works for the UAE and for the Gulf monarchies, who are also feel threatened by Iran. So really, they're trying to turn this into a multi-state alliance again against Iran. And any resistance forces in the region are going to be blamed on Iran. That's what's happening now. And it's the case that Iran is the country that gives the most support to these resistance forces. But they're independent forces. They're not controlled by Iran. If they get some support, some kind, well, good for them, frankly, from my point of view. But Israel wants to pump up the Iran threat, definitely. They want to use this to stop the JCPOA from being reinstated. They want to use it to maintain their conservative Gulf monarchies also. And they're afraid of what would happen look at what happened in Iran back in the day, the revolutionary Yemen back in the day. That would unleash forces of popular movements and resistance that the Israelis don't want to have appearing in the region.
Hamza Shirvan, Iran has come out based on the most recent attacks that were heavy, causing a number of civilian casualties, saying that there's a lack of serious determination to advance the political settlements in that country, that obviously what's happening is going to lead to the destruction of the country and instability across the wider region. Why do you think there is a lack of determination for political settlement?
I think Saudi Arabia and UAE know exactly that any political settlement is coming would mean that Ansarullah or the government of Sana'a right now would be part of it. And they will have the majority there because they are right now expanding in many areas. They are the most powerful Yemeni party right now in Yemen. So the dread of them is absolutely, not something attainable at this point. For them so that's why they tried to advance in Shabwa and Marib, because they thought that they can actually make them weaker and then go for a political settlement. But this doesn't seem to be working for them very well in Yemen right now, and it's actually hurting them because the longer they stay in this war, the more they could be hurt in their countries.
All right, let's look at within the U.S. Jim Kavanaugh and what the Democrats have done just in the past 24 hours. They have said to Biden, you need to clarify the U.S. role in the conflict. And basically, the Congressman Peter DeFazio making this push. Jim Kavanaugh, are you with us? Wow. Okay, he's not with us. So, Hamza Shehban, my question goes to you. You have some Democrats, in this case, Peter DeFazio, who's a congressman there, saying that Washington needs to offer more, needs to clarify its stance. My question to you is, well, how much clearer can Washington be if Biden just approved over $600 million in sales to Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, see, the U.S. cannot hide from, they can't cover their role in the war in Yemen. They're very complicit in this war, and they need to be held accountable. They're the main or the biggest arm exporter to Saudi Arabia and to UAE. I think UAE has a very apparent and obvious role in this war, and it's their war in Yemen right now. I don't think it's Saudi Arabia's or UAE's war in the region anymore. It's U.S. war, because if you think about it, Yes, if U.S. really cares about Saudi Arabia and UAE and their stability and their safety, you know, they need to stop arming them and selling them weapons, because this is only getting back to them. This is only giving back to U.S. with economic benefits. But down the road, these economies might be hurt, and hurt badly, to a point where they might not be able to defend themselves anymore. So I truly believe that you know, U.S. And other Western governments, they don't really care about Saudi Arabia and UAE and their safety. But it's more for them. It's just a game where they you know, they sell them weapons, they get money, but they don't really care about their future and their safety.
All right. Well, we do have Jim Kavanaugh back. Jim, I'd like to go back to September of 2021, where the U.S. came out with a stance on Saudi Arabia and removed these missile defense systems and Patriot batteries. It was announced back in September of 2021. Why did the U.S. do it or take this step at that point, when it's still obviously actively involved in one way or another for the security of Saudi Arabia?
I'm not sure, frankly. I think maybe because they weren't working very well. But that's a very good question. And I think also it had to do, well, I'm really not sure why they did that in September 2021, because as you say, they don't want to stop selling. For the United States, a lot of these wars are just excuses to keep selling arms. And the Patriot, taking out the Patriots, maybe that was Biden just giving a nod to his promises to, you know, withdraw military aid from Saudi Arabia. And he did something like that, and he thought it wasn't going to be terribly important anyway, because as we saw, those missiles didn't prevent the attack on the Saudi oil refineries. So other than that, I really can't tell you. But the United States seems to be, and I think they are, I disagree a little bit with the other guest here, I think they are concerned about Saudi Arabia. They don't want Saudi Arabia, they don't want these conservative monarchies to disappear and to be replaced by any kind of popular democratic revolution. They don't want that. Now, they're not as concerned about Saudi Arabia as they are about Israel, that's for sure. And they're not as concerned about Saudi Arabia maybe as they're concerned about selling a lot of weapons. But there's an important point for the United States in maintaining these conservative monarchies in place throughout the Arab world.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you. Jim Kavanaugh from New York, writer and political commentator. And Hamza Shaban, thank you. Yemeni activist and political